X-Files X-Cast Podwatch. This is episode 92, covering the episodes Alone and Essence. I'm your host, Darren Mooney, and joining me is author and expert, with a hyphen, Chris Knowles. How are you, Chris?
Fantastic.
Cool. It feels like it's been even longer this time since I last talked to you. But today we're going to talk about the episodes Alone and Essence, which are two late eight-season episodes. And I think that, like, From reading your blog, and I think from reading your commentary and chatting to you a little bit, I think we're both perhaps fonder of the eighth season than I think a lot of people are, if I remember correctly. I think that we have a sort of a soft spot for it.
Well, I'll tell you, this separates the wheat from the chaff, in my opinion. The eighth season, a lot of people who like really take the X-Files seriously are really into the eighth season. I mean, the people who really... You know, a lot of people who are sort of on board from day one, you know, from September 10th, 1993 on, people who really were into some of the ideas and themes and the background of those things, or, you know, people who are more into, you know, horror and sci-fi rather than the whole chippy romance element. So it may be a minority, but it's very powerful and
a very telling dividing line.
Yeah, it's like the people who are really into the eighth season are, you know, almost always the people who take the X-Files seriously rather than take the X-Files as, you know, entertainment. So
I like that you mentioned this on an eighth season episode podcast. So listener, when you're hearing us say this, we're talking about you. You are awesome. We love you very, very much. You have great taste in X-Files episodes. But I actually do. I really, really like the eighth season. And one of the things that I like about it is that, well, first of all, it's got a return to the old Vancouver sort of feel. It's a lot darker than the sixth and seventh had been. But it's also, I think, it's structured in a way that's very clever. It's the first season that I think is pretty much entirely serialized in terms of being like a flowing story. And it's structured in like, it's got nice three-act structure. So you have your first act where, you know, Mulder's gone and Scully's getting used to Doggett being there. It's got your middle act where like Doggett and Scully solve cases for four episodes and there's a book-dwelling Indian midget. And then you've got like your final act, which is like Mulder coming back and what the hell happens with the show now. And one of the things that I like about Alone is that it's a very clever sort of structural choice here, because the season begins with a two-parter, which is Within and Without, and then it goes on to Patience, which is an episode about a giant Batman. And then it ends with a two-parter, which is Essence and Existence. But the third-to-last episode, the anti-penultimate episode, I think, is Alone, which is an episode about a scientist who turns himself into a lizard. So you have this weird thing where the season is bookended by these two mythology episodes, but either, you know, within that, then you have like a weird comic book episode. So you have like Batboy or Man Bat as drawn by Neil Adams, and then you have Alone, which is basically like the lizard as drawn by Steve Ditko. Because it's a really crazy like concept for a monster, and I like the episode kind of keeps it on the sideline a bit, but it's very, very comic booky. It's a mad scientist who basically turns himself into a lizard and hunts and eats people. Is the core content of the episode. But that's not really what the episode's about, because you get the sense that that's just like a premise on which they can hang all this stuff that's happening with Mulder and Scully and with the character of Layla Harrison, who's a very interesting character, if I remember correctly.
I would use the phrase incredibly annoying, but interesting, you know, is a good way to put it.
I think she works better here. She was named for a fan with a terminal condition, I believe.
Yeah, which is very sweet, which is very nice of them.
And I think that she works reasonably well here, where she shows up and she's like a super fan of the X-Files and she asks annoying continuity questions and references Squeeze. I think that when she comes back in the ninth season, it's a lot more mean-spirited.
Well, look at the context in which she comes back. She comes back when the show is really on its last legs and the writers are getting nothing but lambasted.
So the attitude towards fans has somewhat shifted. So they go from being very cute and affectionate, which they are here, to being a source of people who won't shut up complaining about Doggett, which Layla Harrison sort of becomes in Scary Monsters.
I think that's Vince Gilligan's contribution, because Vince Gilligan was very upset about the way, you know, particularly that Robert Patrick was received. And if you know Vince Gilligan, I mean, this is a guy who seems pretty, you know,
he has a dark side to him.
Yeah, well, he obviously does. It comes out in his writing. But it's like, you know, he's almost like an old school Virginia gentleman. He, you know, he doesn't have anything bad to say about anybody. But he was clearly very irked. And I think that comes out in the writing of Scary Monsters. But, you know, Alone, I just want to make this point because, okay, so Chris Carter and Frank Spotton has sort of had this maxim of that they're all mythology episodes. You know, they're all tied into this overall narrative. And that might be stretching, you know, the rubber band a little bit too far. But to me, Patience and Alone here, you can sort of tie them into this overarching idea of like human experimentation and genetic engineering, you know, and all these sort of, you know, say syndicate side projects where the syndicate wouldn't just be funding research into purity control and black oil and corn and bees and blah, 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 blah. But they would have like these, well, let's try this. I mean, maybe if we combined a human and a bat, that might make a good, bioengineered slave. Or if you combined, you know, a human and a lizard, you know, maybe there are other, you know, genomes that we should be throwing into this mix here. I mean, it doesn't make any difference to the aliens. I mean, they don't think there's any difference between us and a bat in any way. So, you know, I mean, that to me, it's like, it's almost something like I understand why they didn't do so, but I almost wish that they tried to maybe even just like a little bit hints that this was playing into the overall continuity, that this was part of the overarching narrative, that this was part of, you know, this whole theme of, you know, these incredibly rich and powerful men, you know, who came together after World War II from all these warring factions to, you know, basically declare war on everyone else. I mean, just if they just kind of tied that together, I think these episodes would have a bit more resonance is what I'm trying to say.
It is an interesting thread to pull because it's very much a Monster of the Week episode. And in some ways, it's the last Monster of the Week episode with Mulder, obviously, because Duchovny would depart at the end of the eighth season, move on. But one of the things I like about the eighth season, it has this structure of like Mulder, when he comes back, has no idea where he belongs. And what he learns over the course of the eighth season is he wants to become a father. And there's this interesting theme in the eighth season of Scully gently prodding Mulder towards becoming a better father than his own father was. And like, I think that with Alone, you sort of see that where like Duchovny talked in interviews about hating his return in the eighth season because he didn't want to play the Obi-Wan Kenobi role. But I think that's actually a nice role for Mulder in this stretch of the season, because you have this idea of like, he's about to become a father because it's, you know, Scully's baby is quite obviously his baby, even if the show hasn't admitted it yet. And like this idea of him being the responsible parent to Doggett and sort of handing stuff over to Doggett is basically like him stepping into the father role. And I think that's a very, like, we talked a bit about how one of the big recurring themes of the X-Files is this paranoia about parents and fathers and stuff. And I like Mulder's journey in the eighth season is to becoming a father. And I like that. I really, really like that. I mean, Alone isn't a 5-star episode. It isn't a great episode.
It's solid. Clumsy. It's very solid. Yeah. I think it's solid.
Yeah. Yeah. But it's, I like that it has that theme and it follows that idea.
I think one of the things that helps that process along is, I think that Duchovny and Robert Patrick had fantastic chemistry. I really do. I think they
really did, particularly in Viennan, for
example. Yeah, I mean, I think they played really well together. And I know that they really enjoyed playing with each other. You know, Robert Patrick said, it was probably during the shooting of Viennan that, you know, David Duchovny said to him, it's like, you know, I'm really having fun. I'm really enjoying this. I might, you know, I'm thinking about maybe doing this next season, you know, and then he said he never followed through with it. But I mean, you can tell that those guys really like playing against each other. And I think this is just, I think why Robert Patrick was so important, not just because of his acting skills, not just because of his screen presence, but because of like the personality of who he was as a person. There was, you know, tremendous amount of tension and hostility and bad feeling in the seventh season, you know, all across
with the lawsuit.
Yeah, I mean, just all across the board. I mean, everyone. And you sort of see that, you know, in these episodes.
Fight Club, yeah, Fight Club for example.
Example. Yeah, that's a great example. I think that Robert Patrick's maybe his unappreciated or unrecognized contribution is that he just sort of came in and he got along with everybody. He was almost like, you know, if you have like a really upset stomach, you know, you take some Tums, you know, because the, you know, like the alkaline cancels out the acid. And to me, to like Robert Patrick was sort of like the alkaline that sort of neutralized a lot of the acidity that was circulating on set at the time. So I think that, again, I mean, solid actor, played really well with Duchovny. You know, I'll tell you something. I'm not exactly sure that he played really well against Gillian, because I think that they're, the dispositions of their characters were a little bit too similar. You know, Doggett was repressed and methodical, and Scully was repressed and methodical. You know, I'm not exactly sure that really makes for scintillating,
exciting television.
Yeah, I mean,
that's why I would argue, yeah, the weakest part of the eighth season is the middle run of episodes where they're actually investigating X-Files episodes together, X-Files cases together. It's like Selvage, Badla, Shorekill, where it's like you have to slot them into a traditional X-Files narrative. You don't have the sort of framework of, oh my god, Mulder's gone, or oh my god, Mulder's back. And I think that, yeah, the X-Files, the eighth season does suffer when it basically says, well, look, these are your two leads, start making standard X-Files episodes, and you can't really do that. So Essence is the penultimate episode of the eighth season. It's episode 20. It's the first part of a two-part season finale with Existence. It's directed by Kim Manners. It's written by Chris Carter. And it's basically, it's the start of the culmination of the eighth season mythology, where things begin to wrap up and where you're sort of heading into the birth of, well, what you know is Scully's child at the moment, but what may or may not be confirmed to be Mulder's child very, very shortly. And actually, I have a soft spot. We talked about how we like the eighth season. I have a soft spot for Essence and Existence because they feel like a finale.
They feel momentous. I mean, they feel like something that the X-Files had not previously done, is that they feel like a climax, a conclusion, you know, that you were being led along and strung along for eight seasons. And it felt like it was, you know, this is what it led to. This is, you know, this like, you know, there's a child being born, you know, there's the horrible new conspiracy being exposed. I mean, it's like it went somewhere.
You could leave them here and it would be grand. Like, you could never see Mulder and Scully again after the tracking shot. I don't want to step all over. I know you're talking about Existence tomorrow. I don't want to step all over it, but you could leave Mulder and Scully there and it would be a perfectly valid place to leave them.
Well, I'll tell you, when I watched that last scene in Existence, I'm like, oh, please end the series now. Please, just do it. Don't go to a ninth season. Just don't do it. It's like, just end it here. It's perfect. It's, you could not, if that was the end of the X-Files, if that's how the X-Files ended, I mean, you cannot possibly imagine like a better,
a more appropriate,
yeah, a more appropriate, you know, just, this was like the fulfillment of all the shippers' dreams. I mean, if they ended it here, all the, you know, the problems and the controversy and everything that had come before and everything that would come after would just be negated, because people go, oh my god, that was the greatest season finale, greatest series finale ever. And it didn't really happen.
Yeah, that's it. The biggest problem with the eighth season is the existence of the ninth season. I think I've argued before and will probably argue again. But it is, I really, really like the two-parter because it's got this, like, it's got this thing that runs through the eighth season as a whole, where it's like the old mythology is trying to reassert itself. So you have here, you have the human doctors conducting experiments on fetuses, which is like, it's an old mythology staple. And you have like the attempts to sort of restart an alien colonization plot that was sort of hinted at in like Permanum, for example, and otherwise in the season. But then basically you have Billy Miles showing up and basically karate chopping a dude's head off. And it's like, no, you can't go back to the way things were. Like, you can't reset it. Like, even if Mulder's back from the dead, you can't go back and have Mulder and Scully doing Monster of the Week cases. Because you talked about this when we were talking about, like, Alone and how the show changed and needed to change. And, like, one of the things I like about the eighth season is that it understands that and acknowledges it. And it seems to actually build it into the story, this idea that you can't go back. And, like, you have that with Krycek. Krycek is an embodiment of, like, the old mythology from, like, seasons 2 through season 5. And he becomes, like, this sort of albatross around the show's neck, where he wants to, you know, in like, Dead Alive and This Is Not Happening, whatever, he wanted to kill Scully's baby and resurrect Mulder, which would basically roll the show back to season 7. But the show repeatedly says you can't do that. And I like that about it, where it understands at this point that it needs to change. And it's willing to do that in a way that's...
It was willing to do it, but it didn't actually do it.
No, it chickened out.
I think there are a number of reasons for that, but an interesting bit of history here that a lot of fans might not be aware of is that Krychek was supposed to appear more often than he did in the season, but he was also supposed to appear with Laurie Holden as Marita Covarrubias. I mean, they were supposed to be much more active players in sort of shepherding along this this new phase of the conspiracy. I mean, this is the interesting thing that I always quibble with people when they bring this up. It's like, oh, well, they ended the mythology in Two Fathers and One Son, and then they try to start it up again. It's like, no, it's the same mythology. It's like there was a major battle that was won by this rebel faction, but then, you know, the colonists regrouped. I mean, this is what happens in wars. I mean, battles are won and lost.
Even if you look at, say, 2001 Son, that, like, of the conspirators, I don't think any named characters died. The elders die, but they don't actually have names. You know, the cigarette-smoking man who is, you know, who's obviously Spender, he lives. Diana Fowley lives. Krychek lives. Marita lives. Like, it's not an ending. It is very much not an ending, despite the fact that even Carter, I think, in some of the interviews around the time, sort of seemed to slyly hint that it was. It is not an ending.
Yeah, well, I'm just going to go on record about this again, is that there was absolutely no indication whatsoever that they intended to end the Syndicate mythology in the sixth season. Absolutely the contrary. You know, the junkets, the press junkets that that Carter and Spotnitz did prior to the that season, they talked about how
like
they...
The TV Critics Association.
Yeah, like all those kind of things. They talked about how they wanted to expand the mythology, that the mythology was going to become much more driving part of the next season. And then all of a sudden we see Victoria Jackson and, you know, and one and Ed Asner. And it's just like, what happened? Something happened. Something happened behind the scenes. I don't know if we'll ever know. There are a lot of things going on with Chris Carter. There are a lot of things going on with Fox. There's just a lot of things that probably nobody is going to ever talk about, but that
something happened
because there was absolutely no indication that they planned on, they didn't even hint at it. They planned on ending the mythology in the sixth season, you know, and like I said, they made very explicit statements to the contrary. So something happened, but this is television. Something's always happening. You know, there's, you know, so many different power centers that you need to sort of balance out. There are, you know, interests and actors and egos. I mean, there's just so much involved. We'll probably never know, but I'm just saying, that was not actually their original plan. So reboot, you know, and it's interesting. I mean, they sort of, when did they reboot the mythology, you know, the colonization mythology? They reboot it when David leaves. So that might maybe give you a little hint about what was going on behind the scenes. I mean, I'm not sure, but, you know, maybe it does. I'm just saying.
You have literally written the book on this, yeah, by I mean, the way, yeah, to be clear. To this
correlation is not causation. You know, I understand that, but I'm just kind of saying, you know, they went back to basically traditional X-Files storylines and the mythology and the colonization and all that thing when David left.
Actually, I want to sort of point this out because, I mean, one of the things about the eighth season is that there's a lot of discussion about how it is a new or reboot of mythology. And again, this is something that I read that you wrote, which I think is a very astute point, which is this idea of, like, the super soldiers to many people seem like a new addition or a radical twist to mythology and that they're different from, say, the Black Oil, the alien bounty hunters. But as you quite rightly have pointed out, like, super soldiers were built into the mythology from, like, very early on, from the outset, from stuff like, say, Sleepless, for example.
No, earlier than that, because I'll have to double check, but I believe that the phrase super soldier is used in Eve.
Yes, I believe it might be as well. But I mean, even then, it's part of the context of that as well. Like, and it is that ties back into that whole military-industrial complex as like the cornerstone of like the, you know, the American century, so to speak, or the first half of the American century. And I think that it is like it's a nice logical, organic sort of element. And one of the things I like about the Super Soldier mythology is the idea. Well, first of all, it's simple and straightforward, so you can focus on like Mulder and Scully and their relationship with the child and stuff. But you also have stuff like it allows Carter to almost, I think, deliver on something that he'd been promising for a while, because it's in is it three words or maybe it's This Is Not Happening, where Absalom is talking and he's saying, you know, people are wondering why the world didn't end at the turn of the millennium. And the answer is that it has, and colonization has actually begun. So like after six seasons of like teasing people with the project and the plan and colonization coming and being like the preparations being laid, I like the super soldiers as like, okay, colonization is actually happening now as a mythology, as like an organic development of the mythology.
But it's not happening. See, the reason I like that storyline, you know, expanding on what you just said, is that it's not happening like Independence Day, and it's not you know, it's happening by, you know, what some character, I'm not exactly sure, said, but it's like, you know, insidiously, you know, subverting, you know, the government from within. You know, that the super soldiers are always cops or soldiers, or, you know, they're always people in authority. They're always people who are being placed to under...
It's a silent coup.
It's a silent coup. I mean, you know, Billy Miles is a great example. I mean, what was Billy Miles? He was a cop. You know, I mean, the at the end of this storyline that we're discussing now, the park ranger.
It's the FBI agent, yeah. Well, it's not even... Yeah, it's also the FBI agent has turned out to be as well. That's a very astute observation.
Yeah, I mean, so that's, you know, it's like they're taking over. It's the kind of... you know, they could have gone on with a storyline if they just didn't say the word super soldier. I mean, it's just like, oh, the word just grates on the ears.
Well, it's also a comic book concept. It's also like, I mean, the eighth season is very dark and very grim, but it's also, and we talk about this when we talk about Alone and Patience, it's much more infused with comic book sensibility than I think a lot of the X-Files stuff before. And like Carter, I think, always was a bit of a comic book fan, despite what he may say.
Yeah, you can tell by his, listen, that dialogue. Yeah. Like we've discussed, you know, in prior episodes, that's comic book dialogue. I know that dialogue. I read that dialogue, you know, a hundred thousand times.
From Chris Claremont and from John Byrne and stuff.
Well, it all goes back to Stan Lee. I mean, it's basically Stan Lee. He's basically writing Stan Lee dialogue. You know, so you can tell what he grew up reading.
One of my pet peeves is like one, and this is the thing I have an issue with The Truth. I know that you're actually a very big fan of The Truth, and we won't talk too much about it. But one of my peeves about like the eighth and ninth season is that they do something. I think this is right when you said this about like the Goodwin years, is that they underplay everything. And I think that when you get to say the sixth, seventh, and eighth seasons, they start labeling things a lot more and they start making them more explicit. So instead of like purity control is a very like evocative phrase. It's like it's almost poetic and stuff like that.
But it's also it's like very Nazi.
You know what it
means. It's like scary. It's intimidating. Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah. Super Soldier is just like, well, like it's like something you'd read on a can. It's a non-brand sort of equivalent of an X-Files conspiracy element. You know, it's not like the project is moving forward. The date has been set. It's like, no. The problem with, or one of my issues with the eighth season is that it's like, no, we're actually going to say the word Super Soldier.
We're actually
going to label this. And
that was a bad decision. But that didn't come until the ninth season. And, you know, in all fairness, I mean...
No.
We didn't hear the term Super Soldier until that conversation with Lucy Lawless's character in the second part of Nothing Interesting Happened to this episode. So, you know, we didn't hear that until later. So it's
just retroactively tainting almost.
Yeah. I mean, it's again, you're absolutely right. It's just like, you know, the waft, the stench sort of travels back in time, you know.
All right, well, with that in mind, then, if people want to check out your work, where can we find you, Chris?
SecretSun.blogspot.com.
Cool, and you're also an author on The Complete X-Files, which is also available in updated and expanded expanded edition at the moment.
Yeah, expanded, but not necessarily proofread. But still, it's a fantastic, you know, I mean, any X-Files fan, I mean, you just have to have it.
Yes. I can attestify as an X-Files fan, I can attestify, and as somebody who wrote my own book, which I may plug in a moment, that is something that it was a very informative and very useful text for me, as well as just your blog as well. So I wholeheartedly recommend people check that out. For myself, if people feel interested, I've got a book, Opening the X-Files, which is available from Amazon or wherever all the books are sold. I've also run the movie blog, and I run the 250, which is a podcast looking at the top 250 movies of all time as voted for by IMDb users. We'll be back tomorrow, but until then, remember, trust no one.